Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. My name is John Purcell. Today our guest is one of Australia's best-selling crime novelists, multi-million copy selling Michael Rowbotham, who is best known for his crime series featuring Joe O'Loughlin until his standalone novel, Life or Death, beat J.K. Rowling and Stephen King to the Gold Dagger Award in 2015. His new standalone novel, The Secrets She Keeps, is a brilliant edge-of-the-seat thriller, the idea for which first occurred to him way back in 1991. He put off writing the book because it presented some very difficult challenges. Sarah McDewling, Booktopia's Crime Buzz editor, joins me as we talk with Michael and together try to uncover why The Secrets She Keeps was such a difficult book for him to write. Thank you very much for coming and speaking with us, Michael.
It's a pleasure being here.
And I'm joined by Sarah McDewling.
You are. I'm here.
And we're going to be talking about The Secret She Keeps, which is Michael's new book, a standalone thriller. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are actually going to be quite happy to hear about it from the success of your Gold Dagger winning novel. So what motivated this book? What was the story behind this book? What have we got to expect in this particular book?
The Secret She Keeps, I can't tell you the seed of the idea that triggered it because it would give too much of the plot away. But it is based, as most of my novels are, on a real life event and dates back to about 1991. And about a missing child in 1991.
That's something that you learned about way back then?
Yeah, I know. I was a journalist in the UK and I covered this story about a missing child and it intrigued me. And for a long while, I couldn't work out whether the idea would make a great short story or a novel. And then I realised that the best way of doing it was to do it through two voices, which is, it's a very different sort of novel. I guess of all my novels in the past, this one falls more into that category of domestic noir, very much in that sort of girl on a train, gone girl territory. It tells the story of Agatha and Megan, two women from completely different worlds. Agatha works in a supermarket stacking shelves, and she looks forward each day to the arrival of Megan, who is this elegant and chic customer who seems to have the perfect life, a beautiful, house, a very successful husband, two wonderful children, and also a successful mummy blog that Agatha reads every night, when she's at home waiting for her wayward boyfriend to call. So they're from two different worlds, but they're both pregnant and both of their babies are due on the same day. And so that's a sort of setup, and really it's narrated in both their voices. And so a huge challenge for me to write from two female perspectives. They both have secrets and their lives are going to collide and do about halfway through the book in the most dramatic of ways.
Well, this is one of those books that it makes it very easy for booksellers because the proofs went out a while ago and we get to meet booksellers at events all the time and we're always talking about what books are reading and we're always passing around. And the consensus around this book was pretty much unanimous. Everyone was gobbling it down.
And it slayed me.
Yeah.
I was just like, I mean, it's a dangerous thing to say in the bookselling world, but I'm going to actually commit and say this is my favourite book of this year.
You're still young.
We passed the halfway point.
Yeah, this is we're halfway through the year. I'm allowed to pick a favourite book of the year, and it's this one. I'm always amazed by the way that you're able to create these characters that are so compelling but also so sympathetic. Everyone in this book is great. Like, you've got your two perspectives, and they're both compelling to the point where you've got that great situation where you end one chapter and you switch characters and you're not disappointed. You're like, yeah, what's going on with you now? And so that propels you through the whole book. However, I did favour one. And I'm not going to say which one because I'm desperate not to give anything away about this plot. But
it's a hard book to review because of the major twist that happens halfway through, and I guess the trick of this book was to make both characters equally sympathetic, and again. I mean, I did it once before in Night Ferry. I wrote my third novel. I wrote a book entirely from a female's perspective in the first person, which terrified me at the time. I mean, well, actually, no, it terrified me afterwards, because it wasn't until afterwards that I realised that the majority of fiction readers are women, and that men trying to portray women in the first person, we can make a lot of mistakes. And readers are very quick to pick you up if they think you've got it wrong. And the idea in this book that I would do two female voices and do that sort of literary cross-dressing, that was the enormous challenge to get it right. And it's great coming from a woman, you know, Sarah, to hear that that's what you want to hear. Because I must admit, when it first went out to my publishers, I kept saying to them, make sure I want women to read this. I want, in the publishing houses and my agent, I want women of every age group to read it. I want to know if I've made a mistake here. I need to know if I've got the voices right.
Oh, I thought 100%, to the point where I got a bit teary in certain points, because I was just like, oh, being a woman, it's hard. Like, for sure. And I wondered, I know that back in the day you did a lot of ghostwriting, and if that is something like just getting in someone else's head.
Definitely, I suppose. No, it's true. In terms of capturing a female voice, I ghostwrote for people like Lulu and Jerry Halliwell, and you know, about four of the people I ghostwrote for were women. And it does help to capture the voice. I didn't get help. I'm surrounded by women. I have three daughters at home, raised three daughters. I think the cat and I have both been neutered, so we're the only men in the house. And that's questionable now. I do remember my youngest daughter a few years ago now saying to me, "Daddy, you're not like other fathers, are you?" I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, you don't go off to work in an office." I said, "No, I don't. And you don't go to the pub after work and have a beer." And I go, "No, not normally. No, I'm home. And you don't surf or fish or play football." I go, "No. No, you're a bit of a girly man, aren't you, Dad?"
What a great compliment from your daughter.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're probably right. And so, this is very much a book which, I mean, I think it's for everyone, but I think a lot of reading groups and a lot of women are going to want to talk about it because it raises sort of issues, and they are going to have favourites amongst the characters of who they feel for most and what they think should happen at the end.
Well, it is that perfect book club one, because you want people to have read it before you can, you can't have anyone in earshot and talk about the book at all. Like, this is very difficult to do a podcast around a book that we can't really talk about in great detail. No. We can talk about the effect it's had on us, but we can't really go into
it. Yeah, and I think really, I suppose it's about, to me, all you can really say is it's a book about secrets and in Agatha's case, She wants to be friends with Megan. She envies Megan this perfect life. She imagines that Megan has it all. But of course, when you discover, from Megan's point of view, her life's not perfect. You know, and she also has a desperate secret that she can't let anyone know. And that's where the sort of conflict. And to me, this is more a technical thing as a writer. The challenge of this book isn't just the voices, but to have each of those stories, because you're hearing from these women sort of don't meet until partway through the book, but to have each of their stories so compelling that when you do are with Agatha or you are with Megan, that readers want to be there. It's not as though one's a boring story and, oh, please, let's go back to Agatha, that's more interesting. They have to be equally compelling and they have to intersect, and then they have to sort of explode at a certain point, where you realise that neither of their lives are ever going to be the same again.
Well, you've had a great success with the last couple of standalone books, but you've got your series of Joe Lachlan books going along. Like, when you're in a world that is completely it's got finite beginning, finite end. You can work with this. There's not going to be a second book or a third book coming out of this. Is that less taxing on you, or is Returning to Joe kind of relaxing into a favourite leather couch?
And when might you return to Joe? As a sub question.
No, it's a good question. I think on the one hand, it's liberating to do something completely different, and on the other hand, it's far more challenging because you're starting from scratch. You're creating characters from nothing, and whereas someone like Joe, I know that character Joe Lockner, I know that character so well. I've written sort of 7 or 8 books with him. So there's not much he can do to surprise me as a writer. And so it's far more exciting to do a standalone, but also more challenging. I mean, I'm back with Joe now. The next book will be a Joe O'Loughlin book. I mean, with Joe, because of, you know, the fact they gave him early onset Parkinson's in the very first novel, which is now 12 or 13 years ago, there's a limit to how much I can do or how long I can keep him going. So each book is potentially the last Joe book, or a book that it may be the last for a while. I actually introduce in the Secret She Keeps, I introduce a new character, a psychologist called Cyrus Haven. who has got a really interesting backstory, and he's younger, and he quite intrigued me to create this new character. I was initially going to have Joe O'Loughlin as a psychologist in the book, and then made a decision late on to actually, no, let's make it a proper standalone. Let's not, because otherwise the temptation is for booksellers to say, oh no, it's another Joe O'Loughlin book, and it's not the psychologist book. This, it's very much the Agatha and Megan's book. But I did love the character that I created, and Cyrus, and the backstory I gave him in this, you know. The idea that he's the lone survivor in a family massacre. You know, as a young teenage boy, he came home to find out his entire family had been killed, and that's why he became a psychologist, to try to understand, you know, what had happened to his family. And that's got so much potential for a future book. So stay tuned. There may be a.
I'm so glad.
Sorry, Saban book coming.
I'm just worried about the gestation period it takes to write a standalone novel. You first had the idea in 1991. When's the next standalone novel going to come?
Well, no, I suppose we'll see Life or Death, which is the Gold Dagger winning book. That was 1995. The idea really? For that came up. And you know, the idea of a man escaping from prison the day before he was due to be released, you know, a paragraph I read in the Sydney Morning Herald in 1995, March the 20th, I can tell you the date. And I kept that paragraph for 20 years, thinking there's a novel in this somewhere, it's got to work out where it is. And so I have folder after folder of sort of snippets, not ideas, but just little things I cut out. And sometimes in the case of The Secret She Keeps, as I said, I couldn't work out how to make it into, I can understand of using the central idea of the story, but I needed the two voices is what sold it to me to do the story from both women's point of view. Because to do it from a single woman's point of view, there wasn't the material there. You needed to hear it from both women's point of view.
And it was the aha moment when that happened?
Yeah, and then it was, yeah. But then it was a case of, do I really want to take the risk? Because the one thing with The Night Fairy, when I wrote it, I mean, I got uniformly wonderful reviews, you know, this female protagonist, a 28-year-old Anglo-Indian policewoman. So it wasn't just the gender. I was writing across cultural, you know, I had to think about cultural sensibilities as well, and the whole issue of gender appropriation or cultural appropriation is sort of a hot-button issue. But I do remember when I did The Night Fairy, promising myself, you know, that I wouldn't do it again. I got one negative review, though. It was a woman in the Glasgow Herald that claimed that it was so obvious The Night Fairy was written by a man, and written by a man with a breast fetish. So I went back.
You're so close to Murakami.
I went back and I looked, and there were indeed 5 mentions of breasts. Someone breasted a tape. Several cars were parked abreast of each other. Someone ate chicken breast, poached chicken breast. But there were, in fact, 2 also references to female breasts. But obviously, you know, it was just so clearly that I had a breast fetish when I wrote that book. I'm thinking, oh my God, how can I go there again?
I'm really glad you did.
That question comes up. That sort of thing's come up all the time. And I get worried about, you know, for writers in a climate where people start to say, well, you can't write a person from that is, you know, got Parkinson's because you haven't got it yourself. Mm. And you can't, you know, it just seems ridiculous. And yet it seems to pop up. But, you know, women, and I suppose men are a much simpler beast. And so women writing about men is like a child's play.
Yeah, no, it's funny because, you know, people do talk about, I mean, it's a very famous, which is, you know, not my quote, Jack Nicholson quote from As Good As It Gets, where he plays an author where someone asks him how he manages to write such a wonderful female character. And as you say, you know, he said, I think of a man and take away all reason and understanding or something like that, which is not how I write my female characters. but it's one of those things that I think it, there is a difference. I know, so Josh Whedon, who created the Buffy series, often gets asked, you know, why, you know, how is it, that you can create such a powerful, wonderful female character? And he said, because I keep getting asked questions like that, you know, what, it shouldn't be an issue anymore. I mean, we write fiction, you know, if, and you're right about all this issue of cultural appropriation. I mean, but look at me, I'm a middle-aged white guy living on the northern beaches of Sydney. What could I write about if that's all? If people said all you can write about is what you know, that's going to be pretty boring.
You didn't even have a hobby and took up golf. And golf isn't riveting stuff, is it?
That's it. So,
just when I think I can't hold you in higher esteem, Michael, you quote Joss Whedon. And
like... He got in trouble recently. Didn't that screenplay appear recently for Wonder Woman? And it was sort of a breast fetish kind of a... screenplay, and he got in trouble because when the movie came out, that one of the rejected older screenplays was one of his.
Well, I know Gal Gadot, you know, who plays the Wonder Woman character, talked about the fact that she got trolled mercilessly on the internet when she was chosen to play Wonder Woman because her breasts weren't big enough.
Oh god.
She was because, perfect. That was a great film.
Yeah, it was awful. But yeah, no, it is that issue of, and I am. Sort of, it's funny, I'm slightly expecting there could be a bit of backlash from this book if it's successful, because it is a book about pregnancy and being a woman and childlessness and a whole lot of other issues, that someone will raise their head and sort of say, you know, what right have you got to write about those subjects as a man?
Yeah, we'll take down Anna Karenina and Madame Bovary off the shelf as well.
That's right,
they're rubbish.
You know, there are just such wonderful examples of men and women writing beautifully across...
George Eliot, Dana Deronda, one of the finest things ever written.
But I sort of expect that, you know... But then again, you know, if that happens, it's all publicity, really.
Yeah, it's great. Let an argument ensue. I was wondering, because we've had quite a few authors through here, and we sort of asked them about how current events are affecting them as writers. I mean, it's a kind of a glum... And a dispiriting period we're sort of going through. And then some people do get affected by it. Some people go, well, it's always been thus, and this is just another turn of the wheel.
It's funny, you know, I remember for years after I quit journalism and left journalism, every time there was a major event somewhere in the world, because I knew a lot of the journalists that were covering the event, whether it be in the UK or Australia, a little part of me wanted to be there, you know, and could feel that excitement again. And when 9/11 happened, I realised that journalism was out of my system, because I not only had no desire to write that story, but I actually went into this incredible depression about, well, who would want to read a novel again after what's happened? I mean, no one's ever going to want to go to a film or going to... I mean, the world is... I mean, it's just so fundamentally been changed. Mm. And so for a while, I went in complete funk and couldn't write, thinking there's no point, you know. Although now I think it's different in the sense, you know, given that what's happening in the world, I think it comes back to that escapism and entertainment that people, it is, you know, terrible things are happening, but people can still be transported by a great piece of music or a film or a story, and it can help them forget for a little bit of time, you know, what's going on around them. You know, so there's a place for it.
Yeah, so the Trump thing doesn't get to you, that kind of...
The only reason it gets to me is I'm so completely addicted to reading everything about him. I spend half my day reading everything from the, you know, New York Times to the Huffington Post to watching Stephen Colbert and Jimmy Kimmel do their opening monologues about what Trump's done today. And I should take my middle daughter said to me, Dad, do what I do. She said, just take a holiday and read nothing about him and you'll actually feel much better.
And you'll recapture your ability to actually be shocked by the appalling things. Yeah. Because I think when you're paying attention, you get inured to it. And he could do anything now and we'd be like, well, yeah.
Yeah, it's just him. Yeah,
good. Yeah. So, I think that's the news junkie in me means I probably still spend too long reading. And again, like the latest tragedies of Grenfell Tower and UK, obviously, because I spent so long living in London and close to that area. And I feel for what's happening in the UK at the moment. It's my sort of second home.
Anyone who saw what happened to London and England after Thatcher or during Thatcher, and then see the sort of renaissance, and then see it all coming back down again.
It was one of those things. And I totally agree with you. But even prior to, there were terrible problems in the 70s in the UK as well, and then it'll go through its cycles. Hopefully Australia's not going to go through one anytime soon. But yeah. No, I think it doesn't affect what I write. Maybe to a degree it's one of those things we talk about. I think the angry young man that had a campaigning sort of zeal to change the world is sort of handing the baton on to my daughter saying, okay, well, I'll support you. You get out there and campaign and I'll support you to change the world. But my fight is done. I just tell stories now.
I remember telling some stories while signing, because signing does take some time and there's that opportunity to talk about ghostwriting for different people. Is there anyone, you've got a successful fiction career going, is there anyone that if the phone call came, that you would be sitting there going, I'll accept that. I'll write your memoir. Is there anyone out there?
There's. I can't tell you what it is, but there's one at the moment that's come up which I am seriously tempted to do, but I can't tell you who that is. But I know if my wife was here and if George Clooney came calling, she would demand that I do George, and she would demand that she be the note taker, and if that meant sitting on his knee, all the better.
She would negotiate the whole thing. She'd go, oh, you have to come and live with us. Yeah.
I think she'd like to go to Como. She'd like to live with George in Como.
So with your wife out of the equation, is there anyone that would...
There's certain people I admire tremendously. Not that they'd come looking for me to do it, but someone like Barack Obama would be just a remarkable story to... a bit more than one, I think that's the sort of thing, story you'd want to tell in three or four different books. That's about it. I mean, there are a couple of musicians that have never written stories, rock stars who, if their brains aren't too drug-addled, would have remarkable stories to tell. Mm. Although I don't know whether I have... Actually, I know, saying that, I keep thinking I don't have the musical knowledge, but in fact, they don't want someone with the musical knowledge. Just someone, a true fan that knows can recite every cover sleeve of every album, would write a book that was too dry and boring, whereas you want to write a book from someone who can just capture the essence of the person. So,
Michael, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us. We do like chatting to you. You took a year off from visiting us, which we were very unhappy about. But now we're back into hopefully a year. Is that possible?
I did enjoy that year off, and my golf handicap came down. So, but no, I think I'll do a book a year.
Oh, thank goodness!
I am relieved.
Yeah, and a whole lot of readers around Australia are very happy to hear that. And we just thank you very much for coming in and talking.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
All of Michael's books are available at booktopia.com.au right now.
Subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.